and respect everything she tried to do. People think we are not near fascism, but we are. They think it can't happen here, but it can, and is happening here right now. And if we don't stop it before it gets too far along, we're going to be no better than Germany was in the 30s and 40s.
Wisconsin Judge Hannah Dugan was released Friday after her arrest by the FBI. On Sunday, reporters asked President Trump about the case.
What's next for cleaning up the courts after Judge Dugan's arrest?
Oh, it's terrible. What happened there is terrible. That could happen with a judge is so a shame. And we have to... Look, we have to bring our country back from all these criminals that Biden allowed to come in. These are world-class criminals and people that are insane, people from jails, murderers, drug addicts, drug dealers. And, you know, we have a country. We have to be proud of our country. We can't let these people stay, and the courts are allowing them to stay. And we're just not going to allow it. So hopefully the Supreme Court will come to the rescue of our country.
For more, we're joined in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by Ann Jacobs, a Milwaukee-based attorney who personally knows Judge Hannah Dugan, has appeared before her in court. Jacobs is also chair of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Ann Jacobs, welcome to Democracy Now! What happened here?
It's a fascinating story, isn't it? And thank you for highlighting the fact that the director of the FBI made a photograph of Judge Dugan being taken away in handcuffs, which is just appalling and such an abuse of power. What happened here was, according to the complaint, immigration authorities, six people, two FBI, two ICE, a DE, and a couple of DEAs, I may have the numbers exactly wrong, but six people go to pick up this gentleman in court. Like courthouses across the country, we have metal detectors, so no guns allowed. And they come into the courthouse and they go to Judge Dugan's courtroom and they say, we're here to arrest this guy. And she says, we got a protocol. You have to go talk to the chief judge, whose courtroom is some distance away. And they say, fine. And she goes back in. The interesting part of all this is apparently four of the six go off to the chief judge's office, leaving the two DEA agents behind in the hallway. There's some lengthy discussion in the complaint about what happens in the courtroom, but I think it's undisputed, which is that she allows the public defender and the gentleman at issue to go out a side door. And from that side door, they exit onto the public hallway. In the public hallway are the two DEA agents sitting there, ostensibly waiting for him. The attorney and the gentleman come out into the hallway and they look around. This is in the complaint. They look around. Nothing happens to them. So they walk to the elevators and they go downstairs to leave the courthouse. The DEA agents, we don't know why, don't arrest him. One of them gets into the elevator with them, and they go downstairs, and then eventually he is arrested. That's the sum total of what really the accusations are against Judge Dugan. There's a lot of very breathless, she was stern, she walked quickly, she appeared angry. There's a lot of those sort of salacious tidbits. But in the end, the sum total of what she did is direct him to a side door and send him out to the public hallway.
To a public hallway where the agents yes. could have gotten him there. But she did express anger, right, to the agents before he appeared in court, that they were concerned that they would arrest him in her courtroom. Is that right?
That's certainly what the complaint says. And I want you to think about a couple of things. First of all, if you've ever met a judge, they're not always very happy when their courtroom is being disturbed. Secondly... And the assumption is that the only reason she's upset is that ICE is there to arrest him in her courtroom. In other words, that there's something about him that she is upset about. In her courtroom, she's in misdemeanor court. In her courtroom are witnesses, victims, and the like, for whom an ICE going around, ICE agent going around arresting people can really impede the justice for those folks. So it's not only the fact that somebody who's charged with a crime is getting arrested, and I'm simply reading into the complaint, it is equally logical to be upset about the fact that they're coming into a courtroom where you need to have everyone in the community, documented or not, be able to feel safe.
I wanted to go to Pam Bondi, the Attorney General of the United States.
No one is above the law in this country. And if you are destroying evidence, if you are obstructing justice, when you have victims sitting in a courtroom of domestic violence and you're escorting a criminal defendant out a back door, it will not be tolerated, and it is a crime in the United States of America.
So that was U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi speaking on Fox News. And Jacobs, your response.
As lawyers, we have really strong ethical rules on what we're allowed to say and what we're not allowed to say, in part to prevent impacting a court case, and especially for government attorneys who are required to be honest and accurate and everything else. And I think those sort of comments that she's making are unfortunate and designed to sort of taint the view of what happened here. It also makes it sound like this was going to be a trial and what have you. This was a pretrial hearing in misdemeanor court with an out-of-custody defendant. This is not some day of justice, as it were. It's a pretty ordinary day in a pretty ordinary court where you're going to have lots and lots of misdemeanants, persons charged with misdemeanors in the courtroom. And adjourning the case is not a denial of justice. It's a pretty ordinary thing. And she sent him out to a public corridor where law enforcement was waiting. And law enforcement looked at him and watched him walk to the elevators. It's just a bizarre story.
What message do you think the Trump administration is trying to send to judges as it loses one case after another, scores of cases around the country, whether we're talking about Trump-appointed judges, conservative judges, or not?
The message is crystal clear. If you cross the Trump administration, we will arrest you. I mean, I think that's literally what they are trying to do. So I think the goal is to chill judges from ruling against the Trump administration, requiring that they follow applicable laws and procedures when it comes to detentions, arrests, to require them to have valid warrants and the like. So certainly that's the intention of this, with the hopes that they can cudgel the judiciary into simply becoming meekly obedient to the executive branch.
And Jacobs, we want to thank you so much for being with us. An attorney based in Milwaukee knows Judge Hannah Dugan well, has appeared before her in court. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're staying in Milwaukee now, where on Friday, FBI agents arrested a Milwaukee County judge, Judge Hannah Dugan, after they accused her of obstructing justice and concealing an immigrant from arrest, when, in fact, the federal agents very soon after arrested the immigrant who had appeared in her court. We're speaking now with Emilio Dottore, the executive director of Milwaukee Turners, which was founded by immigrants and refugees in 1853. He's a longtime friend of Judge Dugan, spoke at both the Friday afternoon protest outside Milwaukee County Courthouse and at a Saturday protest in front of the FBI headquarters in St. Francis, Wisconsin, which was held to protest her arrest. Judge Dugan is a former board member of Milwaukee Turners. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Emilio. Start off by explaining what Milwaukee Turners is and your response to the judge's arrest.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Amy. The Milwaukee Turners is a 171-year-old civic society founded, as you said, by immigrants and refugees. We operate out of an historic landmark in downtown Milwaukee, the longest continuously running gymnasiums there. We teach yoga, gymnastics, rock climbing, have trained Olympians there. There's a concert hall there. We do a variety of programs across two counties. In regards to the arrest, this is devastating. It's affecting folks all over, especially as it's rolled into the wake of the confusion of some almost 100 students in Wisconsin who faced a retraction of their F1 and J1 visas. This is just upsetting people all over the county.
You were one of the first people to protest her arrest, to get copies of the complaints against the judge and share them with the public. Can you talk more about what we know about her arrest and how this has affected the judge and the overall Milwaukee community and her long history in Milwaukee?
Sure. People were tremendously upset. I had folks calling early in the morning, alerting me to what had happened. As we shared copies of the complaint on Facebook, we had people reaching out who had gone to grade school with her, high school with her. She is a well-known and respected person, a former executive director of Catholic Charities, worked for Legal Aid, Legal Action, a former Milwaukee Bar Association president. She's not just some secluded figure in a courthouse. She is an active part of the community. She's known for giving out copies of the Constitution and flags on Constitution Day and Flag Day. This is somebody who is well-respected in multiple communities across the city, and this has a devastating effect on our social fabric, and also this sends a ripple of fear. This affiliate here, where I'm speaking to you from, is on MATC's campus, and with students being threatened in Marquette, at UWM, UW-Madison, MATC, Concordia, people with visas, people who may be undocumented, are now frightened to even come to the courts to pay municipal citations or to bear witness to a crime or to file for licensing. They don't understand what's going to happen if they feel as though a judge who is an integral part of the community can be picked up for what is seemingly nonsense, especially if it just appears to be a photo op to frighten other judges.
And can you respond to Kash Patel, to say the least, breaking with convention, ahead of the FBI, tweeting out, using words like perp walk and showing a picture of the judge in handcuffs and writing, "No one is above the law"?
It's absolutely disgusting and damaging. I think it sends an incorrect message to all of these armchair quarterbacks who are just going to believe a short character tweet. And locally, it has devastated many communities, not only just immigrant communities, but all folks who have known Judge Dugan for the decades of her selfless involvement here in the county. I personally find it disgusting that he would use such terminology for somebody so well-respected.
Do you think this has anything to do with the major Republican defeat over the special election for a judge where Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, spent I don't know how many millions on that race and even came out to Wisconsin and spoke and still lost? Do you think this is retribution for that?
I think it can surely be connected to that. I think it's a part of an attempt to stifle the judges, like Ann Jacobs said. It's an attempt to cudgel folks into submission. Hannah is known for elevating the rule of law and for honoring due process. And to make this statement against somebody who has been so admirable in her practice for so many years, it is ridiculous. And the fact that Kash Patel would add this terribly insulting photo and statements to it has actually had a reverse effect here in Milwaukee. I think people are more strongly supporting the judge, more strongly coming out on behalf of immigrants, and more strongly rejecting this message. And certainly you can connect it to the amount of money that they attempted to dump into the state Supreme Court race.
Mm. And finally, in related news, federal agents in New Mexico have arrested a former judge, Jose Luis Cano, and his wife. They've been accused of tampering with evidence linked to a former tenant who the government claims was a member of a Venezuelan gang. That was another judge, a former judge, who was arrested. The overall message being sent and what's happening on the ground now around organizing?
The overall message being sent is being linked to the same types of statements that that were made in 1930s Germany and 1940s Russia. Folks were actively comparing the recent federal statements from the United States to Stalin's statements about repressing the judiciary. I think these actions are just underscoring it. People here in Milwaukee are not taking kindly to the fact that our community, our economy, our family, now our courthouses and our schools are being disrupted by the heavy-handed overreach that we see. It really seems like an unjust and perhaps quite illegal grab into our courthouses, and it is having the opposite effect, I think, that the federal government had intended it to have.
Emilio Dottore is the executive director of Milwaukee Turners, longtime friend of Judge Hannah Dugin. When we come back, we speak with Martin O'Malley, former head of the Social Security Administration. He's issued a dire warning that Social Security could collapse due to sweeping Trump cuts. Stay with us. Heart of Darkness by Per Obu. The band's leader, David Thomas, died last week at the age of 71. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our next guest, former Social Security Commissioner Martin O'Malley, is warning Social Security recipients could soon see their benefits interrupted or delayed. In a recent interview, O'Malley said moves by the Trump administration to cut costs at the Social Security Administration could, quote, crater the agency and lead to a system collapse. The Washington Post recently reported a flood of cuts pushed by the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, and Doge, are already leading the Social Security system to breaking down. The Post reports in March, Social Security website crashed four times in a 10-day span, blocking millions of retirees and disabled Americans from logging into their online accounts. Phone lines have also been overwhelmed due to staffing cuts. According to the group Social Security Works, around half of all seniors rely on Social Security for most of their income, while 25% of seniors rely on it for virtually all of their income. The average annual payout to these seniors is just $20,000 a year. Last month, Trump's Commerce Secretary, billionaire Howard Lutnick, sparked outrage after suggesting only fraudsters would complain if Social Security checks don't go out on time.
Let's say Social Security didn't send out their checks this month. My mother-in-law, who's 94, she wouldn't call and complain. She just wouldn't. She thinks something got messed up, and she'll get it next month. A fraudster always makes the loudest noise, screaming, yelling, and complaining.
Trump advisor Elon Musk recently described Social Security as a Ponzi scheme during an interview with Joe Rogan.
Well, I mean, the government's one big pyramid scheme, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, you can tell me better than anybody.
Social Security is the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time.
Elon Musk's attacks on Social Security come as the Trump administration's moving to cut off benefits to more than 6,000 immigrants who'd lawfully obtained Social Security numbers were paying into the system for years. The administration's doing this by falsely labeling them as dead to cut off their benefits. We're joined now by Martin O'Malley, who served as Social Security Commissioner under President Biden. He's also the former governor of Maryland and the former mayor of Baltimore. It's great to have you with us, Governor O'Malley. Commissioner O'Malley, if you can start off by explaining why you say that you think the Social Security system in this country is on the brink.
Well, because of all of the things that Elon Musk and the Doge team and Donald Trump have been doing to Social Security with a speed and a virulence that I think is stunning, shocking. I mean, they have, Amy, actually been paying people with our money at an agency that was already at a 50-year low of staffing and all-time high beneficiary customers. They've been paying them to leave. They have created a hostile work environment. They have engaged in wholesale, firing an entire offices and divisions. They have driven out almost by now 10,000 people out of the agency. They say 7,000. It's going to go down to 10,000. And part of that is a 50% reduction in the people that keep the IT systems going, the same IT systems that never missed a beat and sent out the checks, the right amount to the right person at the right time every month, all through COVID. They have cut the IT department in half. You're seeing, as you just mentioned, outages in some of the customer-facing aspects of it. Those outages are going to become more regular rather than intermittent. They're going to happen for longer durations. And ultimately, you're going to see that cascade into a collapse of the entire system and an interruption for some time of benefits. I don't see what the path that they're on. I believe they've taken probably 90% of the actions necessary to accomplish that aim.
So can you explain this master death list and putting 6,000 people who've paid into Social Security on the list that says they are dead? We're talking about immigrants and where this master list goes?
Sure. That's an operational question rather than a question about what their intent is. I mean, this is some really chilling stuff. By law, Congress requires the Social Security Administration, which maintains a lot of personal data on all of us from our first summer job, from the first moment we're born, actually. And Social Security is required to keep what Congress has dubbed the master death file. And so Social Security has contracts with all 50 states, the territories, and the second that a death certificate is recorded, Social Security lists that in the master death file, and then a lot of other entities ping off of that. In other words, our banking systems, credit companies, the IRS. And so if you list somebody as deceased, when clearly they're not deceased, it has the effect, as their puppet acting commissioner of Social Security said, it has the effect of terminating the financial lives of people here in the United States. It is a stunning, willful criminal act, any one of those counts, to put a false information into a federal record, and in particular, a Social Security record. And yet they're doing it with a breadth. In total violation, a breadth and a scope and a depth, way beyond anything that's happened before, and actually in direct contravention and direct exactly opposite of what a federal judge ordered them to do, which was stay the hell out of our personal data.
Now, you have at the same time that all of this is happening, the degrading of the system, President Trump insisting that he's not planning to cut Social Security. But can you talk about what you see as Trump and Musk's ultimate vision for Social Security? Do they just want to make it unworkable so that it's privatized? And in this, talk about the history of Social Security. How many people get it, Social Security and disability benefits as well?
Sure. For 90 years, Social Security has never, ever missed a monthly payment. And right now, there are approximately 73 million Americans who are in pay status, who are beneficiaries, whether in the survivor and old age aspect and widows and orphans, or whether it's people with disabilities who can no longer work. Now, the question you ask, Amy, about what their ultimate goal is hard to figure. Social Security, as you probably know, and many of your viewers know, is not a Ponzi scheme. It is a pay-as-you-go program. Americans working this year pay in $1.3 trillion, and Social Security pays out those same dollars to beneficiaries. And when, as now, with baby boomers moving through the system, Social Security makes up any difference from its large surplus reserve. And many people believe it is that large surplus reserve, the only agency that runs a large surplus reserve of $2.6 trillion, that Donald Trump and Elon Musk have their eyes on. I don't know what they want to do with that money, but it does appear that they're trying to precipitate an emergency situation, knowing that Congress would never allow them to touch it absent an emergency. I do believe that they're trying to wreck Social Security's reputation, wreck its ability to serve its customers, wreck its unbeaten string of regular monthly payments, so that having wrecked it, then they have an emergency under which they can rob it.
So if you can talk about what has happened when it comes to, first, it said they're going to cut off the phone ability to call a helpline, which for so many Social Security recipients is the only way they could communicate with Social Security. That would force them to satellite offices, of which they closed many. What is happening right now, and what do you say has to happen to fix this system at this point?
Well, it is going to take years now to build back Social Security. You know, last year, the men and women of the Social Security Administration achieved some of the best customer service timeliness achievements in certainly since before COVID. Some of them, you know, the best timeliness in 10 years. For example, answering that phone used to be an average wait. 42 and a half minutes. They got that down to just over 12 minutes. But now all of those things are going in the wrong direction. Social Security is one of the most trusted brands in the entire federal government, second only to the National Park Service and Smokey the Bear. So what they have to do in order to get away with whatever their end goal is on, you know, with their eyes on that big trust fund, they have to degrade its ability to serve customers. They have to turn people away from it or against it. You've heard a lot of big lies about Social Security. You've heard Elon Musk say it's a Ponzi scheme, just like the rest of our government. Illegal immigrants get Social Security benefits when they don't. You've heard about the zombie apocalypse. That is, you know, millions of people roaming the earth and taking our money. None of those things is true. But the other big lie you hear, Amy, is that Social Security is bad. It's always been bad. It's never really worked. So that's the big lie they're pushing. And then they demonstrate it by cramming as many people into Social Security offices as they can for services that they used to be able to get online or used to be able to get on the phone. And that's going to be the evidence then that they create that it's always been bad. So, you know, we had to privatize it or we had to liquidate it. Here's your lump sum. Be happy. Go away. It was always a Democratic program that never worked. So that's what's going on here. And it's happening with a stunning speed that I think is Americans are waking up to.
And in the 10 seconds that we have left, this allegation that, you know, immigrants are being fraudulent in getting Social Security, they have paid into the system for years. It's their money.
Well, actually, illegal immigrants, so-called, people working here outside of legal status, cannot receive any Social Security benefits and never have been able to. They're prohibited by law. But they do pay in $25 billion for the benefit of the rest of us and into the Social Security Trust Fund. It's a total lie. Illegal immigrants do not receive Social Security benefits.
And yet they pay. Martin O'Malley, thank you so much for being with us, former Social Security Administrator.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.